So do you just want me to hop right in?
Great.
Great?
Sure.
Literally, we'll go down and dink around in the water. So I'm Katie Monson, and I'm from Santa Cruz, California. I teach environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, there in Santa Cruz. But people don't usually know what UCSC is right off, but that's where I teach. And one of the classes I get to teach in environmental studies is freshwater ecology, and I've really taken a liking to that whole field. I love it. I love that whole field. And one of the things I learned how to do as part of teaching, as part of when I was first a TA for that class and then started teaching it, was to learn about these macroinvertebrates in streams. And so that's what we're going to look at today. I thought it'd be really interesting to look at that up here in this place and see what's going on with these macroinvertebrates. So our goals for today are I'm going to give you just a little intro to creeks and some of the language around creeks before we go down, and thinking about connections with groundwater and ultimately the lake, and then look at a couple of what might happen with water quality based on the mine. What studies have already been done, and what do we know a little bit about? And then just to teach you a little bit about these macroinvertebrates and their place in the food web, and then go out and actually try to collect some and see what we find, and see what they can tell us about the water quality. So that's the plan. If we get excited, if anybody gets excited later, we can do math at the end and really calculate indices for it, but you know, we'll see how far we want to go with all that. So first, I just wanted to show you, I want to draw out a creek, and I want to give you a couple of words to go with creeks. So you have these. So a creek comes along, kind of like that. So with somebody next to you, see if you know any of these words. Oops, I'm getting excited about F's. So riffle's a word, a pool is a word, a run, a fallweg, which is a fantastic word, and a reach. So see if you know any of these and where they might be along a run. Yes. Yeah, this is above. This is above, and the water's flowing like this.
I mean, riffle is like.
Is the difference between a river and a creek just the size?
Yeah, it's essentially a lot of the processes are really similar.
Okay.
Yep. All right. So, anybody know a little bit about riffles? What's a riffle? A little bit about. Some ideas.
Is that where the word ripple came from?
Oh, it's a lot like ripple, and ripple are really similar. Yeah,
a little rapids.
Yeah, it's like that. So it's where a riffle is where the stream bed is interacting with the water a lot. So
it's rocks.
Yeah, you see rocks, and it's interesting because if I'm going to a stream and I'm coming back to it a couple times, those riffles will be different depending on the depth of the water. So so if I'm kind of looking at the stream this way now, and there's gravel here, and there's a big rock here. So if the water's low, here's where really the riffles would be to start, right? If the water level was bigger, here's where it really would be interacting more. Whereas it would be going smoothly over that part. So that depends a little bit on how much water there is at the time. And this tends to be where it's really interacting with the stream bed, tends to be a little bit more erosion in those areas. And then pools.
Wider body.
Yeah, it's going to be wider, it's going to be slower, it's going to be deeper too, usually. A deeper area where the water's going to come in and slow down. So it'd be going quickly around and then slow down in a pool and then keep going.
Can you also sometimes, can you get in a pool, it'll actually circle?
Yeah, you can get eddies going.
Where the actual current actually changes, goes back upstream a little bit.
Oh yeah, probably like a little bit. Yeah, right, like this way, for a little bit like that. I mean, in Santa Cruz, we get our whole river flowing backwards with the tide, right? The tide will come in and push water upstream, but we're not really experiencing that effect all the way here.
Is the run right after the pool? When it starts to run faster right out of the pool?
Yeah, so a run is deep water with more rapid velocity. So the pool's where there's deep water is slow, and a run is deep water and fast. And so again, that's going to change a little bit too, depending on how much water is actually in the creek, right? Anybody know Fallwake? Such a good word. Poor underused word. Fallwake is the line of the most rapid velocity in any section of the stream. So essentially what I've drawn here is like looking at where the Fallwake is.
What's the root of that word? What?
Boy, I sure don't know. Where do you get a word like Fallwake? Seems like maybe is it like...
Sounds like a Dr. Seuss word.
It does sound like a Dr. Seuss word. It's Seussian. Or maybe, I don't know, like, is it like Scottish or some? Like where we get all those weird words from with glaciers? Not weird, but words around glaciers. There's a bunch of Scottish glacier words. Okay, and then a reach is just a set of riffles and pools. So riffles, pools, runs, so you call a section a reach. It's rather loosely defined by what you're working on. All right, and another thing to know just about streams and rivers, which I started to talk about here too, is there are different sizes of particles in a stream, and I'll tell you the sizes first. So if we start at the very, very smallest, we have clay particles, and then a little bit bigger is silt. And by the time you get to silt, it's very smooth and flowery feeling. And then after silt is sand. You know what sand feels like. And moving up from sand, there's gravel. And above gravel, there's cobble, which is kind of like a little bit rocky bed. And then there's boulders. There are a few other words that will get thrown in and around here. These are generally the size classes. And there are very specific numbers that go with these size classes, which you don't really need because you don't need to memorize them. There's not actually going to be a test at the end, right? But it's just moving up from tiny particles all the way up. And what's really interesting about these have different, it's going to take more energy to break these, or it's going to take different amounts of energy to bust these out and erode them. And they're also going to fall out of suspension in rivers at different rates. So it's really hard, actually, to bust clay, and it's really hard to pull out boulders. You need really fast-moving water to do both of those. And the way your places you will find erosion tends to be where you have a line of rapid water that's going to hit a bank, right? And then as it comes out here, as it makes that turn, it's going to start to slow down. As it gets to the pool, it slows down. And so you'll see sandbars forming, right? And if you look at a sandbar, you're going to see that the biggest particles fall out first. Well, the biggest ones, if this hit any boulders and pulled them out, they would drop them pretty rapidly up here. And then they'll drop out cobble and then sand and finer particles as it goes. And if you think about it, if you step into a really slow area of the creek, what does that often feel like under your feet? Do you know, like the gushy, right? So you're stepping in this silty matter that's been deposited slow when the water has slowed down the most, and it's just finally settled. It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to see. We'll probably be able to see some of this when we go out. But next time you look at a sandbar, you can even see it on a very small scale. I like to point it out, like on just the dirt roads at my girl's school. You can see that when there's a little bit of water traveling downhill and eroding, you can see that it's where it's picking up particles and dropping them, even like on like this scale. It's really cool. Bigger ones dropped first and smaller ones dropped after that. So watch for that in the next rainy season. And so, let's see, so there we have those different particles, and where they're picked up and where they fall out really influences what that river or what that stream looks like. Okay. And so then, who's living down here in this pool? So what we're looking at are benthic, and then macro, and invertebrate. Okay, so with somebody next to you, what do these things mean? What's benthic and what's macro and what's invertebrates? Then I'll tell you too. Testing all your old or non-existent knowledge.
Where's algae in that?
Algae, we're not looking at the algae today, but I'll show you where the algae go.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so anybody know what benthic is? Do you know benthic, the benthos?
I've been thick before.
That's it. So how's benthic? But then other benthic things are down here this is the benthos. This is the bottom part of the river or the creek. So we're looking at things that live along the bottom of the stream. So they live down here. They live either on the surface of rocks or they actually live right down here, right in the upper part of the substrate. Okay, so there's that. And then macro, I think I heard this out
there. Big.
Yeah, macro is big. And so they're big enough to see. We can see them when we're going to pull them out of the water. So they're not, we don't have to use a microscope to see them. And then invertebrates.
No spine.
Yeah, they don't have a spine. So there's all these creepy, crawly creatures that are big enough. They're small, but they're big enough to see. And they live in the benthos. And so worms count, and snails count, and clams, if there are any freshwater clams. And then all these little organisms that turn into other things. And I'll tell you about some of them in just a moment. And so these are important because they play a variety of roles. As when a leaf, this is not a philosophical question, but when a leaf falls into a forest stream, like, does it make a splash, right? So it's just thinking about what happens to organic matter when it enters the stream, and these organisms play a lot of different roles with not just organic matter that's falling in, but organic matter that's growing and interacting. There's all kinds of interactions going on in here, and they're involved in that. So there are some that are collector filterers, and they're living down here, and they're collecting, I can't actually talk and write at the exact same time, filterers. They're filtering out fine particulate organic matter, right, from down here. So they're going through the substrate and getting little tiny bits of organic matter, the last little shreds and bits of leaves and algae and other organisms that are down there. So that's what they're eating. They're filtering that out. They're taking it in and filtering it. And similarly, there are collector gatherers. They're picking up a little bit. They're picking up slightly bigger organic matter from down there. So they're down here just either filtering or picking up bits of organic matter as they go. And scrapers come along the rock and they literally scrape algae. There's your algae now. Algae and diatoms off the rock. So they'll scrape that off and eat it. Off of rocks or off of woody debris. Then there are shredders, which are not, in Santa Cruz I have to tell my students those are not skateboarders. Right? So shredders. And the shredders are taking like this leaf, they're taking coarse particulate organic matter, they're taking the big stuff and shredding it up into littler bits that then other organisms are going to eat down the line too. So that could be leaves, wood, live plants, anything along the way, they're going to eat that. And then there are also predators that live down here. And the predators are eating other macroinvertebrates. So you have all of these. So they're either ingesting whole or parts of animals, or they're piercing their tissues and sucking out the insides. All kinds of really fabulous ways they're going to get their nutrients, right? Okay. And then these, in turn, what eats these macroinvertebrates? Anybody know? What might be eating these? Fish, yeah, totally fish. Yeah, some birds.
Yeah. Do we have any bats here?
Do we have bats? Yeah, I imagine some bats might use these, especially not when they're in this stage, but then when they're going to hatch and emerge. Some of them are in larval stages down here. So they're connected to this bigger food system too. All right. And so what it turns out that these organisms that live down here in the benthos, they have a range of pollution sensitivities. Some of them, like especially a lot of fly larvae, really don't care what is going on pollution-wise. A lot of fly larvae will be able to grow in some pretty nasty situations. But other organisms, and there are three groups in particular, they really need clean water overall as a group. And those are three of those, the key ones are EP and VT. So there's Ephemeroptera. And these are the mayflies. And the Plecoptera. They are the stoneflies. And the Trichoptera. And they are the caddisflies. And these are kind of my favorites. Not that I can have favorites, but I really do love Trichoptera. So I'm going to pass out these so you have these to start looking at. These are guides.
Yeah, I guess I can just
you can just pass along. So Ephemera and Trichoptera you'll see in there, or Ephemera and Plecoptera, they're identified by the number of little, So you can see we'll try to identify them on here, and it's taking through first, do they have jointed legs or no jointed legs, and what are they? And then a little bit more about what kinds you can find down there. And on the very back page, I know you're never going to step in the water again. So down here are the Plecoptera and the Ephemeroptera. They're just these little guys identified by the presence of gills or not, and how many little cercae, like tails, they have off the back. There's what dragonflies look like before they become dragonflies on the back, and damselflies. These four along here are all larval forms. So that the eggs have been laid, they hatch, they are living and growing. Is this sometimes for a year or more in this stage before they emerge as flying insects above the water. Others, like there's some Coleoptera, there's a really great little beetle called the water penny. Some of these beetles live in or mostly in the water. There's a diving beetle that grabs an air bubble and then dives down and uses the air bubbles like scuba for invertebrates as it goes down. And that's how it's breathing underwater. And Hemiptera, these are water boatmen, if you've heard of water boatmen, water striders, fall under Hemiptera. And the caddisfly larvae are the Trichoptera. They're on the previous page. Oh yeah, that's a water penny right there on the top, on the far right, that little flat thing. We'll see if we find any. They're really cool. The Lepidoptera are the moths that have an aquatic life stage. And there's Megaloptera. They have mega legs. See all those little legs along there, Dobson flies and alder flies. And then the Trichoptera. And the Trichoptera are really my favorite. We saw one when we scouted out the site the other day, so we'll see if we can find some more. But the Trichoptera, they're called the casemakers. Caddis comes from the caddismen in I think in England, they were traveling salesmen and they would sell ribbons and bits of fabric, but ribbons primarily, I guess. And so they would pin them to their body so that they would be visible, the wares, as they went. And these caddisflies collect whatever material is around them and make it into little shells that then they live in and come out and grab food and go back in. And the caddisflies, they, depending on the species, they make very different cases. Some will use like two, they have very clearly like two medium-sized rocks along the back and little sand along the bottom and the top. Or some will make, they'll take bits of leaves and sticks and make a little, almost look like a little fir cone in the water. Or some will use all sand and make a particular long tube. This really neat to see the forms that they do. They're all different. And then after a while, they grow and emerge. Some people have, there's someone, I think in France, that has taken, has made use of these caddisflies and puts them in a tank with bits of gold and emerald and makes jewelry out of the cases. The caddisflies make the jewelry into make the cases, and then I don't know if they're true. We'll have to look into caddisfly rights and how those are determined. I don't know. And so different ones of these, they have these different pollution tolerances, and these dear little caddisflies, along with the mayflies and stoneflies, just really don't like pollution. And so if you find them in your waterway, you can say, this is probably pretty good, pretty clean water. And so that is what we're going to do. So what kinds of pollution? So again, if somebody next to you, think about what kinds of pollution might organisms be finding in creeks? What might they be sensitive to?
So the creeks anywhere?
Yeah, creeks anywhere. What are different kinds of pollution that freshwater organisms would be dealing with? So you can think about that for like 30 seconds. See if you can think of any. All right, so what are some of the kinds? What kind of pollution might we see in freshwater systems?
Storm drain runoff?
Yeah, and so what's in that storm drain runoff?
Oil, grease.
Yeah.
Dirt of a different kind.
Yeah, oil, grease. Fertilizer is a big problem. If we have fertilizer, even though that's like especially nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, those are things that help plants grow, but what they'll do is they'll help algae grow or weedy plants grow, right? So that really changes the ecosystem.
What about pesticides?
Yeah, pesticides. Definitely they're dealing with pesticides, especially if we're talking about insecticides, and many of these are insects, right? So very definitely sensitive to that. I'm hopefully not going to fall. That's all right. Okay.
Metals.
We have some metals at our back door, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Acids
too, right. And there's some other funny things. Heat is actually considered a pollutant. Because, so you may know what happens with dissolved oxygen. Dissolved oxygen is what organisms need to survive in freshwater ecosystems. Mm-hmm. What happens is your water warms. Where's that dissolved oxygen?
It goes out.
So warm water holds less dissolved oxygen, so then the organisms can't breathe. So heat struck me really funny, kind of, I guess, the first time I heard that heat is classified as a pollutant. Another one is medicines, residual medicines from humans. Are also pollutants.
Manure.
Yeah. So the manure falls under here.
Right.
But also, I heard over there too, right? Like the bacteria in manure too. Probably also some hormones and things and medicine for the cattle, right? So that in there too. Great. And so here at Holden, what we've got is a lot of our primary pollutant is the metal that's been coming from the mines, right? And so what they looked at is Railroad Creek is listed officially on the impaired water bodies in the U.S. And it's category 5, which is the highest category, but not like yay, highest category, like uh-oh, highest category. for several different elements. So you can probably start guessing what is showing up in our waterway, what is too high in Railroad Creek in particular.
Copper.
Arsenic?
Yeah, arsenic.
Aluminum.
Let's see, aluminum didn't officially make the list.
Iron.
And iron also did not officially make the list. But another mining metal, right? Mercury. And lead.
Cadmium.
We don't have, and cadmium also didn't make the list. I think these are the main, culprits.
No zinc.
What was that?
No zinc.
No zinc on the official, list. Or at least for this section of Railroad Creek. And so even starting back, because we've had people excited and up here around the village for a long time, and since the late 1960s, people have started doing these kinds of studies on the creek. There are at least 4 published studies out there. And what this information is out of, there's a quality, QAPP, quality assurance protocol, but I'm missing a P in there. But when the mine was going to start the remediation work, they had to hire somebody to do a long-term monitoring plan. And out of their long-term monitoring plan, it talks about exactly they're going to do. There's a group that's going to look at the macroinvertebrates as well as periphyton, which is just peri is on the top and phyton is plant growth. So they're looking at algae on the rocks. So they're going to measure macroinvertebrates, periphyton, the habitat, looking at the habitat structure, and then water quality, probably by taking water samples. So they're going to do all of this until 2024, or until sufficient evidence shows that the water quality is recovered. So this is what they're going to be doing. They're going to be doing the same kind of thing that we're going to go out and do, and see what it looks like. And they've already seen that over time, what has happened is if they looked at the creek, and so this is up creek, so that way, and this is down creek, and there's the mine influenced section in the middle, and they looked at the total number of taxa, how many different kinds of organisms they could find in a square foot. So I'll put number of types per foot squared. And this is logarithmic, it's 1, 10. This is not a perfect graph by any means, but it's swift, all right? So the upstream, overall, the averages, they were finding somewhere like this, they were finding different studies. And then by the mine, where the mine influenced, they drastically dropped, like by a factor of 10, right? Or even more, or like maybe almost a factor of 100. And then below the mine, they come up a little bit, but not nearly as high as they were before. Right? So it's cool because you can use these little macroinvertebrates to say, yeah, it's really clear. It's harder to live in this area that's really heavily influenced by the mine. And even downstream, it's harder than it was upstream.
But Katie, they've changed the river. They've narrowed it. It's not a natural, all the riprap they put in and everything else. So isn't that going to influence? This could really be clear, but you're not going to get the same type of flow and natural flow and everything else in this stretch.
Yeah, right. And it'll change if you don't, depending on the substrate, if you to get a really thriving fish population, everything, you need different sizes of substrate, you need down logs. I saw that they put in like woody debris though. They're trying to mimic that in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll show you when we go out there.
But I don't think they're ever going to reach what they have upstream.
Until everything is leached out, right?
Well, that's a different issue than the minerals, right? It's just the physical environment, the size of the boulders, the straightness and the steepness of the creek.
Yeah.
The amount of logs that they have in there is still only 10% of what you would expect in an up creek or down creek.
Right. Some of those will change over time too, just as winter happens and processes happen, right? That the things will move into the creek and change that probably over time. I'm guessing.
And the creek was changed originally with the mine. So
yeah.
it's been basically a ditch between there and there for since 1936 or so.
Yeah, they fixed a lot of those issues down below that footbridge, but right here it's still in straight shot. So it makes me wonder, what's the criteria for recovery when you have so many factors and some are not fixing right? So you fix the leaching of metals, but they're not, you know, maybe they only fix 25% of, you know, expected boulder sizes, so sediments and dumb blocks.
Yeah.
And creek quartz.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know for sure what that will look like and what the mountain will contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also sunlight, right? Oh, sorry. This sunlight is just all, it's all in the sun. But when the trees grow, that would change things too.
Right, and those have different effects. It's kind of funny because at Santa Cruz, it's just humans, we still don't know what we're doing is kind of a problem. Right, so at Santa Cruz we have an endangered red-legged frog on our campus. And some students tried to restore a stream by planting willows to create more habitat for the frogs. What they ended up doing was shading out where the tadpoles grow. And so the tadpoles need to eat algae that grows in sunlit areas. So now this massive stand of willows has shaded out that area and decreased the suitability of the spot for tadpoles. So we're always just, we don't really know. We don't really get the whole thing yet, right? We're learning slowly. Yeah.
Well, so my question's related to that. What would you expect this graph to look like if the mine had never been there?
If the mine had never been...
It would just be flat?
Yeah. I'd expect these to be really high.
Okay. Like, even though, like, the elevation's changing and there's different...
Yeah, different kinds.
Okay.
Until it gets close to the lake.
Okay.
And the lake, that's a whole other interesting story, like the lake itself and the water going into the lake. And that, I mean, Chelan is a lot like Loch Ness. I take my students one quarter, and then we're going to go outside in moments. One quarter, when I was teaching the class, well, I always have them do this the first day. I say, write down if there's something that you're really interested, that you really want to make sure I cover in freshwater ecology. And so I finally had a quiet moment while they were taking an exam, and I was flipping through these things from the first day. Sometimes it takes me a little while to get caught up, but it's all right. And I'm looking through these, and one says Loch Ness Monster. I'm like, oh, that's silly. And I turn, and another one says Loch Ness Monster. And then, like, two more. I'm like, fine, we're going to look at the stinking Loch Ness Monster. But it turns out to be a really interesting study to ask, like, could there actually be a Loch Ness Monster in Loch Ness just ecologically as an ecological question? Because Loch Ness is similar in a lot of ways to Lake Chelan, that it's very, very steep and deep. And so the place for anything to grow on the sides is very small. There's not very much room for that. But it's also different in that it has a lot of, up on the hills in Loch Ness, around Loch Ness, there's a lot of peat. And peat leaches really dark-colored humic acids into the water. So the water is deep. It's really, really dark. It's cold. For a lot of the year, there's very little sunlight reaching the loch. And so when they open the bellies of trout, which would be the top predator aside from Nessie. So the top predator aside from Nessie is starving from like January to March each year. It doesn't have enough to eat. And so I was thinking about that the other day when we were driving up in the boats. Could Chelan support a monster?
You haven't heard of the Lake Chelan monster?
Is there a Lake Chelan monster?
Well, it could be.
Well, it could be. I wouldn't be expecting any invertebrates in here. Not very many macroinvertebrates. Because they don't have, there's just nowhere for them to hang on. But as long as the creek is flowing, basically until it gets to the falls, then the macroinvertebrates, right? So, but for a long way, I expect there to be different kinds. There's a whole other idea, too, called the river continuum concept. that talks about what kinds of organisms you find at different stretches of a river, starting with the headwaters, the creeks and the headwaters. And the community changes as you move through forests and different kinds of forests and grasslands, and as it opens out, it changes who can live there based on essentially how much sunlight and what kinds of organic matter are falling in, things like that. Yeah.
So are there falls between here and the lake?
There is, when it reaches, boy, I haven't walked all everything, but Railroad Creek goes into, does it go into Dom? Where does it go?
No, it goes straight to the lake, but there's definitely lots of falls.
Okay.
So, falls the fish from Lake Chelan can't get up.
So why are there fish here?
Why are there fish here?
How many fish have been introduced here, and how many
I don't know that.
I mean, the fish in Railroad Creek are natural populations, presumably, I don't know how the trout got here naturally, but there are some natural that are thrown out of things, and then there are stock trout, and practically all the lakes in the forest are stocked and minor stocked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a smattering of things.
Katie, it seems to me the figures can be skewed very easily if you're only taking 1 foot, 1 square foot, and trying, where if you go anywhere up and down this river, you might choose 1 square foot where it doesn't match and you say, oh, it's not working, where you could go 20 feet further and get the same matches upstream.
Yeah, you would, to do a good scientific study, you would take a bigger area, and these would be averages over square feet. So you would, yeah, you would need to.
So will they do that? I mean, it'd be easy to skew these figures.
Yeah, the units is critters per square foot, but the study includes a large area.
Yeah, yeah. So the study should be, I assume they're going to do a good job with it. But we should come out and monitor them. Yeah. Maybe we'll have to do that. Monitor the benthic macroinvertebrate monitors.
Okay.
And so what we do then is you put nets down in the water and you just disturb the substrate above the net. And then you see what flows into your net. And you pull it out and you look at it in sample jars. So if I'm doing this as a study, I did this up in the hills above Santa Cruz in the Boulder Creek watershed. I would do that. I would do this I'd set my watch and I'd do it for a certain number of minutes. And I'd pick out 5 riffles and then I'd use a random selection tool to randomly select 3 of the riffles so I wasn't skewing the results. But based on which of the 3, pick 3 of the 5 randomly, do them for a set number of minutes, like 3 minutes. Take these out, really make sure I collect everything, that everything in my nets goes in my sample jars. Take them, then they'd be killed in ethanol. Take them back to the lab, and then really there's a method for sorting through them. We're not going to be quite that methodical. Quite that rigorous. What was that?
We've got over an hour left.
We do. We could really do some major sampling efforts. Yeah, and I'll also, when I do that, we're just going to identify them to class in here, but I'll take them down, or to order, I'll take them down further when I look at them. Yay. So how's that for a little intro? Is that to kind of see where we're going with all of this? And the results, you can find results online from when the Holden class, one of the students did it, but there's funny things in there, like, which we've had in our samples, is like one of the Megaloptera ate the other ate. Our numbers were decreased because of one of the invertebrates eating the other invertebrates in the sample jar. I'm like, yeah, that happens. What was that?
What were you reading from regarding this particular?
I think I got all of this out of the the QAPP. It is online, and I can get that for you if you like.
That'd
be very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I can take down names at the end. Just remind me, and I can send you, because it really goes into like the logistical problems, the history of the study area, the parameters, and really every QAPPs are a bear to write, because you have to tell everything in your chain of command and who will touch things and who, how they'll be signed in and out, because they, what they want when you're doing environmental work like this, you really want it to be, that you're going to be able to take this into a court and say, this is exactly what we did every step of the way, because people will want to say that you didn't, or that you did, you weren't doing sound science. So if you have a federal grant or anything, you need a QAPP, and there are pages and pages. So it'll be even more than you may even want to see. But lots of interesting stuff.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So we're ready to go out and see what we find in the creek. I'll show you where we're going. Travis kindly brought us things from that we have here at Corbin.
Are we going upstream from here or down?
We're swimming upstream. All right, we're not swimming. We're walking upstream.
Oh, yes. Okay.